Section number 16717, John Everett, Reel 7.
Mr. Everett reads Reel 7. Do you recall what you were doing as you approached the Marath line?
Mm-hmm. Well, we were in the assembly point under a few of these palm trees, and that's when I actually joined what I said previously, and we got our instructions what we were going to do. We were told we were going behind these frail tanks, and the engineers, we were going to give the engineers covering. They were going to blow the anti-tank ditch up for us to get our tanks across, but we had to go across this wadi. And apparently further down the wadi, the water was about 2 or 3 feet deep, unknown to us that, but we didn't actually cross that, but some of the battalion did, must be in different companies. But as just before we set off, he must have known or spotted us were assembling, so he opened up with his artillery and was starting. That's when we got orders to move out. When we moved out, well, artillery was barrage from both sides and was terrific. And we were moving into it instead of moving out of it. And then my number one brengunner was a lad called Johnson, and he had his brother, Sergeant Johnson, in the same company. Well, we were pinned down. We all got down because, as I told you, the barrage was terrific. And then we got orders forward, and then that's when he shouted he'd been hit. This lad, and he was number one brengunner. And I had a look at him, went across to him, and it was like a back of the hand, and it seemed like a big hole in the back of the hand, shrapnel on. And I shouted across to his brother, the sergeant, and I said, "I'll see to him." And he said, "I'll take him to the field ambulance." And he took him back. Well, naturally, then, when we went forward again, we had no sergeant, no brengunner. So you could understand the position we were in. Then we got to the top of the escarpment, and it seemed steep. And then it must have got our range again, apparently. Oh, and they were dropping all, they were getting knocked out left and right, our lads. And this frail tank had, we were behind this frail tank, and this had been knocked out apparently, and was just overlooking the wadi. So we got in this ditch there to see if the shellfire would ease off a bit, and then it was starting to break dawn.
What's it like being under such severe shelling?
Well, actually, you can't describe it. It's terrifying. Especially when it knock it not far, 100 yards, 50 yards from you, and they get all the bits and pieces off them, you know. You actually can't, that's what I'm saying. You get young people and you train them, and you actually can't. It's impossible to tell them what it's going to be like when they're actually in the fray of it. It is frightening, you know, To me, like, shellfire is worse than bombing, because with a bombing raid, you're there, and they're off. They drop their bombs, and they're off. Like, we used to get a lot of raids off the Stukas, you know. And they, once they bomb you, they're off. But shelling's there, continues all the time. And they lift barrage, and they have their OPs the same as ours. So they must have known everything was going on. And, it was chaos, put it that way. And when daylight broke, you could see our Bren carriers in the wadi. There must have been, I counted 7, I think, all bogged down. Nobody there, not a soul about, just shell fires. And he did it east then. Then we kept moving forward. There's about four of us, and then all of a sudden, from our left flank, there was I can't say the word for it. Just firing, and stopping firing, and they were firing towards us. And one of the lads said, "If we crawl along this part of the anti-tank ditch, that's where the direction is coming from." And it wasn't actually daylight then. I forget what they call him, but we got as far as it then, it was going over our heads, and we could see the pill, like a pillbox. So we got up to there, and he shot a grenade in, and it stopped. So we moved from there, and then we seen about, must have been 10, 15 lads on the, all in the slit trench, and I forget the name of the officer, he shouted, "Come get yourself in here." And we got in there then, and I don't know who they were, put it that way. And then we got told to dig in, and then that's what we were carrying. Well, that's when we could hear this from a minefield on the right. We carried this lad. He'd been in the minefield all night, apparently, and his heel was hanging off, and I think I told you about it before. Well, I was dealing to take him back to the field ambulance, and then he had to cross this fixed lines, which we knew where it was, and he just bent down and he just, you know, we carried him. And I was talking to him. When I was talking to him with his language, I said, "Yeah, are you Welsh?" He said, "Yes, I come from North Wales." I said, "I do myself." I said, "It's all right for you." I said, "You going out of it?" I said, "We going back in there." And the next night we got told we were going further, going in again.
Were you amongst those that got out of the anti-tank ditch by making a human pyramid up the side?
No, I wasn't. That happened on the first night we went in. We passed higher up, lower down. That's where the water was deep, and they had to put ladders down. Talking to some of the lads in this trench here, they were some of them. They had to put ladders down to get down, because that's deep. You know what I mean? Because you got, it's like everything else. You're with that lot there, and I'm with this lot here, and you're all different experiences in a particular battle. And when he went in the following night, at the cross of mine, they said, "We have to go across a minefield." Well, if you stay, that was your number. There was nobody to pick the mines upon out. So unless we assembled again to go in, there was a big dugout. It wasn't one of ours. It was one of he'd had his trucks in. And there was about six or seven of us died for this, for shelter. And I don't know what told me. He said, "Get out of it." And I got out of it. As soon as I got out of it, there was one dropped amongst them. Somebody told me to get out of it, and I got out of it. And then we went forward again, and it wasn't what he called light or anything, really dark. And it was confusion again. There was firing from all angles. So I got in this bit of slit. I see a lad in this trench. It wasn't maybe a foot. Got in there with him, sheltered from the shell fire. And I was talking away to him. And it's breaking daylight. I said, "What time is it?" I said, "I don't know what's happening now. Everything's like died down." He was dead. He'd been dead all night, and I didn't know. There wasn't a mark on him. So I just left him. I never interfered with his body. You know, could have took his identity. That's up to the burial party.
Did seeing the dead and the wounded affect you in any way?
Unless it was very close to you, you know, like might be a mate or something like that. Otherwise, it was one of them things. But if he was wounded, you'd try and help him as best as you could. Otherwise, because you all carried field dressings, you know, if anybody was serious, you'd really put a field dressing on, if it was possible. But under them circumstances, everyone's things are his own. You think of your comrades, like, but you think of your own life and all at the particular time. And then Well, I went for daylight then, and I could see this, and well, this trench was deeper than this room. I forget the depth of it, but, and I could see two or three, and they shouted, get down. I said, how do you, he said, get down. So I slid down into this deep trench. There's one on a stretcher, and I don't know, there was another two, I'm not sure. And all of a sudden, from, I don't know where he come from, but these must have been like the old-time trenches. I reckon it was the French in the First World War, I don't know. And all of a sudden, this officer come round the corner. He said, they're counter-attacking. He said, get on top of them, pick them off. To me, like, I only had my rifle. And I said, where am I going to stand, sir? And we're still shelling, you know, coming over. He said, get up, pick them off. So I made like a foot hole, and I got up, and I could just see them, because we were looking down at them then. We were like on a mound, looking down at them, and he could see them coming in single file, like we do, must have been four. So I fired about three shots, and then I slid down the bottom, and then when I looked down, he was gone.
Who was it?
I believe it was Major Warren, and he was gone. So I was surmising after he put me up there for him to get away. I don't know. And then
he didn't show any signs of being wounded, did he?
No, at that particular time, not to my knowledge. There was a sergeant looked on the top, looked down at us, and he spoke to him. I don't know who this sergeant was. He was unknown to me. He said, I got onto this other part of the Marist line, he said. And I shouted down to him, and he shot me, he said. And he'd been right through his cheek and come out here and never touched his teeth. And he was all out talking, like nothing happened. He was talking to this officer. And then he went. I don't know where he went. And that's about, must have been about 10 minutes, quarter of an hour after. He said was moving up. All of a sudden he said, put your hands up. Give yourself up. And this fella, on the stretcher, I think it was, he said, put your hands up. And I was looking what was happening, like, and he was there, he had a stick grenade, and he's had a revolver. One of them at the back of him had a stick grenade. He said, I'm only telling you once more, put your hands up. And I was the only one there. So I went up to him, I put my hands up, and there was tears, because tears come in my eyes then. I put my hands up, and he stuck a luger in my stomach. He said, for you, the war is over. I said, God, he's going to bloody shoot me, to my own mind. And I was like more or less crying. And well, tears in my eyes, I thought, I actually thought he was going to shoot me. And then they passed us along, their troops, you know. And this German officer detailed somebody to carry this wounded fellow. He never detailed us, me. And I was on my own then. My knowledge, there was nobody else there, and I was getting passed along, and then this fella took over. And as he took me over, there were some more stragglers, what we call stragglers, our own different battalion. They were coming from another sector, I could see them, but our artillery opened up. Terrific barrage, and we were in the middle of it. This German jumped in his sled trench, I jumped on top of him, and another German got on top of me, and they were getting nearer and nearer, and that's when I copped it with ours, all over shoulder, bits in my face, only splinters, and I was bleeding. My shoulder would seem more than anything else. And then it more or less eased off the shell fire. And when we got up out of this trench, a fellow looking after me, he said, English pigs, and there was quite a few German dead being caught in the open. And that's when he said that to me, I spit at him, and that's when he woofed us in the stomach. When he woofed us in the stomach, I fetched blood up. And then he took no notice, and then we were marching, and there must have been a few join. He was in charge, and he took us to a house, must have. You could see our dead all over the battlefield. There, that was their position. But unknown to them, I knew, the New Zealanders were going around the back, and they'd be cut off if they, we could hang on a bit longer. And they took us into this house, and they give us details that individual go in, empty all, he put it on the table, and they were dressed like a black unit, SS, big swastika hanging off them. And one of the lads, they grabbed him, and I think it was Sergeant McAdams. I believe he was out the 8th Battalion, because I knew him, because he went out the same time as me. This lad had about 8 pence in his pocket, and they were going to shoot him. Said he'd been robbing the Germans, and he talked to the German, but he couldn't understand. He said he'd found him in a tip, you know, like where you've been, and dumped all the stuff. And he persuaded him, then he let him go, but actually he owed his life to that sergeant. I think they called the Sergeant McAdams, I'm not sure, but he's definitely saved that lad, because the Germans were going to shoot him. And then they interrogated. They wanted to know where the Scorpion tank was. That's what they asked me when I went in there. Well, I said, I think it's bites you, a Scorpion. I said, no, he said. Tank. I said, I don't know. Couldn't tell you. We had come in with them, but they wanted to know more about it, you know what I mean? And after the interrogator, what was there, they moved us on. I forget how we went, and we got up on some trucks then, German trucks, and a German guard in the back, like our 3000, something similar to that. And the Arabs was trying to get at us. Arabs wanted to cut our throats, and the German kid hit him with his rifle, give him his due, the guard on that particular truck. These Arabs wanted to get at us. I don't know what tribe they were, but they weren't what you call old Arabs, they were teenagers. And some of them had knives in their hand, you know. That was more terrifying than coming out of battle. And then they moved us on, I don't know, as far as Gabies or Gabies, I think. On that particular part there, we stopped the night somewhere, it was like a little dugout, and they would put us all, what there was of us, 30 or 40 now, didn't know any of them. And this German passed what you call a pani. It's like one of our buns. Passed it around, he knew him when he was there. And we shouted, it was one short. He said, nix. He said, no. Somebody worked the double shuffle. So there was one of the lads there. Had an out. He had to go without, you know. That happened to your own people then. We moved then, and we boarded all these, what they call them, like cattle trucks. I boarded them, and we travelled. We got some water. We stopped. We got some water off them, another bit of bread. And I forget what the name of the place. They stopped on the sideline for a break, and everybody was getting off that could get off, because there was a badly wounded amongst us. And they moved us, carried on with these trucks till we got as far as Tunis. And that's when the first, we put us all in a rubber factory there. And I don't know who this sergeant was. This lad pointed to me, he said, he'll have to get attention. He showed him and bring your blood up. And this sentry then took us from this camp to a private house. And there was a German in there, a German doctor. But it was a house, well, a posh house. And in, and he spoke pretty good English. And he said, I'll see to your shoulder. And he picked, I said, they're only small fragments. He said, I believe I've got them all out. But your stomach, he said, I don't know what's happened there. And he gave us a couple of tablets. But he said, you'll be getting shipped across. So he said, well, as soon as you get across, he said, they'll attend to you there. But there was still no better, like. And then we went back to camp, and then they started sorting us out. Paratroops, one side, because there were some First Army people there and all. We were the 8th Army and the First Army. And they were sorting us out. Infantry, you know, and different. And while I was in there, I met a lad from my own, went to school with, and he was on the First Army side, and he was in the paratroops, a lad called Griffiths. I went to school with him, and that's the place I met him, and I hadn't seen him since my school days. And then...
Had the guards changed? These wouldn't be frontline troops, were they?
No, no. GHQ people, you know. I suppose that would be in a transit camp while that particular, because there'd be people taken before that.
Did they treat you a bit rougher than the front line ones that you'd come through?
These people had, put it this way, they were just there to organise you, you know what I mean? No ill treatment as far as I knew. But when we got up, when they were going to transport us over, they put us in an old collier, I think it was. There was only about three or four crew. That's all I could see. The skipper, every one of them had a life jacket on. And he spoke, the skipper, he said, "We'll be lucky if we get across," he said. "Because the Navy's sinking everything." And we were all down a hold. All of them wounded. They were from all sectors. There must have been a big figure of us in there then. And they were lowering water down. And if you wanted a wet, you just done it where you were. If you wanted a toilet, it was like, well, if you did hit, that was it, because you were like drowned rats, because you wouldn't have a hope, because you were battened down. But they would have been all right. They might have had a chance, because they were all had their life jackets on, you know what I mean? And they landed us at Leghorn. And they put us on... cattle trucks, I think it was again, and fetched us all the way, and that's a long way from Leghorn down to Naples by these cattle trucks. I forget what part was in the Naples area, and we had to go from that Capua 66 camp and march down, and the women were shotting stones, spitting at us. And then they took us in this camp, and then when we went to this camp, everybody was getting interrogated, you know, like, and then another one, every four or five. And a ring on my finger, and it was a valuable ring, they took that off. They couldn't get it off, they sawed it off in the camp. It took everything off us in that particular camp, said I'd get it back, but the ring might be no good if I get it back. Never got no back.
What was the camp like?
Well, take that photo I let you have. All for about three or four strands of wire, pillbox on each corner, manned, continuous machine guns, and the tripwire. If you stepped over that tripwire, you could be shot. But apparently, just before we got there, about 3 or 4 months, I think, there was a big escape from that camp. They went down a sewer, and they were up to there. They were all went down a sewer, went right under the wire onto the main road, and as they were coming on the main road, they were waiting for them as they come out, so somebody must have tipped them off. They all got fetched to the camp. There was another escape while I was in the camp. He broke out of camp, and he got us from Capua, that's not far from Naples, as far as Milan. And he walked in the ladies' toilet, then to the gentlemen's, and the cabin area, a policeman seen him coming out, collared him, fetched him back, just took his boots off him, and he was walking about bare feet in the camp, you know. There was another lad, they'd opened the gates, the main gates, to the compound for us. They used to open that when people were getting deloused. They used to take and get deloused. Take all your clothes and shove them in this tub. Well, this day, this lad just walked straight out. They challenged him three times. Shot him. Yeah. And after you got deloused, you got your clothes back, and there they were, all dead. Can't tell the size of them. Covered in lice. Every morning, he used to take your vest off, pick them off. But I had to go in hospital there straight away, me.
What was the matter?
The same complaint, I was bringing blood up, and then I had what they call, I turned yellow, And according to the camp doctor, he said it was jaundice. He had a touch of jaundice, and I had mimic dysentery, and I was in a terrible state. And I said to myself, I'll never get out of this because I was deteriorated in my own mind. And in the camp hospital, I got put next to that German. I didn't know it was a German.
What were you being fed on?
What we call hot water and a few soaked macaroni or cabbage or anything. That's all water, you know. Out. And if it wasn't been for the Red Cross pals, I don't think many would have survived.
What were the huts like that you were billeted in?
Something similar to our Nation huts. There used to be bunk beds in there, but as soon as you stepped in them, the fleas jumped on you. And most of the lads used to, when it was nice weather, used to carry their little palliers outside, sleep outside or in a compound. There used to be compound, there used to count you into twice a day. Three of them counting you. It took about an hour or more, counting you one at a time into the compound. And while I was there, I don't know if you've ever heard this of somebody else, they fetched a sailor in. And he was only about 18, this lad. And he was the sole survivor of a destroyer or a sloop. And they would interrogate that lad every day. They wanted to know the name of them. He wouldn't tell anybody in the camp the name of it. And the only thing he told us was he the only survivor because he happened to be on watch. And after she went down, he said he was picked up by the submarine. And it was a submarine that landed him in Naples. And every day when we were getting counted, there was big pillars whitewashed in this compound, and he'd drawn a roll of honour on there, and he was putting the names of all the men that, because he knew all the shipmates. He was doing that every day.
How many would there be in a hut?
I forget the figure myself.
It was pretty crowded, was it? Pretty crowded.
The ship, you mean?
No, the hut. The hut that you were living in?
Oh, yes, definitely crowded, yeah. Could be 40, 50, could be more. You know what I mean? There was, like, our bunks, something on the same line, you know. One on the bottom, one in between them, you know. And they were wood, actually, with your Red Cross parcels. It was hard to get a bit of wood to light your fire, because we used to make little stoves, you know. So what he got in here.
How were they heated? How did they keep you warm in there?
Oh, no heat at all in there, except if the weather was all right, that's how, you know what I mean.
Did you have a stove in the hut at all?
No, didn't there, nothing at all. No, there was nothing in our hut. And sometimes there was whole lectures, like camp commandant. He was RSM Burgess, I think they called him. RSM Burgess in the 66 camp. And he used to organise, like, anybody had any particular experience, and he used to as many as he can in this hut, 50, 60, all gathered around, listen to the... There was one airman, sir, there. He was given his experience. They were bombarding Naples just before the invasion of Sicily, or they actually had invaded Sicily, I don't know. But he was saying as they were bombarding, they were hit, and this last thing he remembered, the skipper saying, "Bail out, we're on fire." And he landed on dry land. But he just, when they picked him up, he had no shield or anything, and he couldn't, doesn't know how, unless somebody took it off him with him being unconscious or something. But he was, you know, like, and then this RSM Burgess was telling when he was picked up in the desert, he was in LRDG, Long Range Desert Group.
I think we've got this story. I think it's on the other tape.